Call our last case of the morning. Loft House v. State, 70587. Counsel is ready.
I'm ready.
Mr. Waters, and if you wish to reserve any time.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. May it please the court, my name is William Waters. I represent the Loft House. I'm with the Clark County Public Defender's Office. There's a lot of issues in this case, and it's been a long morning. So unless anyone has anything that they immediately want to hear about, I want to talk about primarily the kidnapping allegation in this case. I think I spent a significant portion of the briefing on that. It was an issue that was actually preserved as well. So we believe that with respect to the kidnapping, when you're charging kidnapping in the way the state did, the act that is alleged to have been perpetuated upon the minor's person, number one, has to be upon the person, so it has to be some crime that you typically think of as a person crime. And then number two, the act itself has to be the illegal act, or an unlawful act, because that's the way the statute reads. So in this particular case, Mr. Lofthouse was charged with kidnapping for basically having a consensual sexual relationship with someone that, admittedly, he's not allowed to have a consensual sexual relationship with. But the sexual acts that Mr. Lofthouse engaged in with the alleged victim in this case, in and of themselves, were not unlawful because she was of the age of consent. So this act then, the act itself is not unlawful. The relationship is certainly unlawful, given his status. So it begs the question, can you commit a strict liability, or can you specifically intend to commit a strict liability or status offense upon a minor's person? Which is sort of an odd, you'd think, if you ask yourself that, you'd think, like, well, how does that happen? So in this particular case, that was litigated up to and including during the trial. The judge repeatedly rejected that argument. So based on that, Mr. Lofthouse then tried to get a Mendoza instruction at trial, because that's really all he's left with at this point. And the Mendoza instruction was rejected. And
what was the reason the judge rejected the Mendoza instruction?
So the judge said something along the lines of, I think that goes beyond what is required in the kidnapping statute in Nevada. Now, I will say this. At the time the Mendoza instruction was requested, the state still had three theories of liability that they were arguably pursuing. The detain the minor from the parents, the hold to unlawful service, and the intent to perpetuate the unlawful act. So I think, and I'm just speculating here, but based on what the judge said, I think he was maybe confusing it with maybe the other two theories of liability, because obviously under those two you're not entitled to a Mendoza instruction. It only applies when you've got an associated offense and you're talking about movement incidental to the associated offense. So, and I know that the state disputes this in their brief, but I don't know how they can, because Ms. Collins did argue in closing, we are not saying it's A or B. It is only three, or C, sorry. It's only C. So we're not arguing keeping him from the parents, we're not arguing unlawful service, so, we're only arguing that he took her to perpetuate the unlawful act. So I think, you know, that might be why, because it's clearly, that's not a correct statement from Judge Johnson. It's not. When you've got kidnapping and associated offense, it actually becomes something the state has to prove. So when he said, well, I think this goes beyond what is required for kidnapping in Nevada, that's...
Well, he took her to the hotel, didn't he? Is that undisputed?
No, he took her to the hotel. That's true. But again, assuming everything happened the way that the state has laid out, and we're not necessarily disputing that, Mendoza becomes important because... The state has to prove that. I mean, this court has repeatedly said, you know, the jury should be instructed on that in all but the clearest cases. And I don't know what necessarily is clear here regarding how, you know, taking her to a hotel would have increase the risk of harm than having intercourse with her in the classroom. And I think it's probably more harmful to do it in the classroom, quite frankly, with students and other teachers and everyone walking around during the school day.
Let's back up a little bit. If she had met him at the hotel,
right,
would we be talking about kidnapping at all?
Well,
she had taken a taxi, ridden her bike, and they went and had sex in the hotel. Would we be talking about kidnapping at all?
Well,
for Mendoza, is it incidental? Is the transport or the movement incidental to the crime?
Right.
Right?
Probably not, although I think that there's a way the state could probably allege it through enticement, like if he sort of enticed her to meet him there, maybe. But yes, if she took the bus there, or a cab or an Uber or whatever, then there is no kidnapping. So I think Your Honor's correct.
Well, right. Is this what the legislature's trying to cover? So you can consent to sex at 16, but you can't consent to a ride to have sex at 16. Do you think that's what the legislature intended?
Well, I mean, honestly, there was some talk in the legislature when they were passing this teacher-student sex law about perhaps amending the age of consent as well. It didn't happen. That's an odd thing, though. So you can consent to actually doing the act, which is part of, I guess, the harm inherent in these types of relationships, and that subjects you to 1 to 5 years in prison, when taking you to a hotel, which is arguably less harmful than doing it in the classroom during the school day, subjects you to potentially life in prison. I mean, I don't know if that's what the legislature's thinking, then I don't know. But that would certainly suggest why the Mendoza instruction was important, so that the jury can determine, like, well, did that? Was that more harmful than maybe doing it in the classroom?
Is it harm or is it incidental?
Well, incidental.
You have to move her to have sex. I mean, that's what you're talking about with Mendoza. We're not talking about which is a better place. The question is, did he move her?
Well, there's a couple of ways.
Was it incidental?
Incidental is one of them. There's a couple. It could be increased risk of harm, independent significance, or incidental. Correct. Is it incidental? If you want to do that in a private place, then I would say yes. Moving someone moving them somewhere away from the classroom would be incidental. Yes. Would be incidental, but...
Is that a jury determination that they should have been instructed upon?
Well, this court has certainly said so, in all of the theories.
In this context?
In this context, absolutely. Absolutely. The state certainly didn't present any evidence that it was either incidental, had independent significance. I mean, it was for the purpose of consummating the sexual acts or increased risk of harm. So, the jury certainly could have, on these facts, said, neither one of those three things actually happened in this particular case, therefore there's no kidnapping. So if there's no more questions about that, I want to go to the unit of prosecution argument. I did submit supplemental authorities. I hope Your Honor's got it and have reviewed them. And admittedly, it's certainly not binding authority, and I'm going to say that right off the bat. It is a, I think it is persuasive, though. Obviously, this issue has never been litigated in Nevada. The unit of prosecution as to the teacher-student sex crime, but Texas has, and Texas has said that their statute, which is very similar, it actually uses the same word, engages, applies to relationships and not the individual sexual act. I think if you look at the legislative history that we cited throughout the brief, well, if for purposes of statutory construction, unit of prosecution, you look at the statute itself, if it clearly authorizes multiple, then you stop right there. I don't think engages in sexual conduct clearly authorizes, multiple charges per act. I think it's pretty clearly talks about a relationship and not necessarily each individual act. But if you go to the other tools of statutory construction, including the legislative history, I think it's abundantly clear what the legislature is seeking to prohibit here, which was these relationships. And they say relationship no less than a dozen times when they're discussing it. They had the ability, if they wanted to, make each individual act illegal, they could have done that. They chose not to. The whole point was that these relationships, there's an inherent power imbalance, so they wanted to prohibit them, just like they do for therapists, patients, so forth. So I think if you look at it that way, the unit of prosecution analysis, then you've got basically one count, because it doesn't matter how many times they engaged in sexual acts within the overall relationship.
Well, there were multiple days that this happened.
Right.
Incidents in the school, incidents in the hotel room.
That's correct.
So what's your argument, that those are separate, but the stuff that all occurred in one day should just be one?
Well, no, I'm saying that it doesn't matter how many times that you engage in certain sexual acts with someone for purposes of the statute, because the point of the statute, what the statute sought to prohibit, was the relationship between the parties.
Okay.
Mr. Waters, don't you, though, clearly in this case, I understand your argument, you have clear breaks in activity. As Justice Gibbons is talking about days.
Right.
You have this person leaving, going home, and then either going to the hotel or coming back to the school.
Right.
So you have clear, definite incidents, not one continuous or something that this party is under the control of the defendant the whole period of time?
Well, again, though, I think that if we're talking about unit of prosecution and what is the statute seeking to prohibit, you know, our position is that if he engages in sexual conduct, what the statute says, we believe that pretty clearly talks about a course of conduct. So it will be one count for the course of conduct, no matter how many days pass, no matter how many breaks there are in the days. We think the legislative history certainly supports that, because the discussion was about prohibiting these relationships between the parties. So the relationship, the teacher-student relationship where the sexual intercourse or sexual conduct is involved, is what we believe the statute seeks to prohibit. So then the it doesn't matter how many times necessarily that it happens or how many days between each incident, because what the legislature clearly sought to...
You keep using that term clearly. Can you point to the legislative history to say how clearly, from your standpoint?
Well, and here's why I say that, because they repeated, well, clearly, in my opinion, because they repeatedly mention relationships. They never said, we want to prohibit a teacher from, you know, having... Well, obviously, they want to prohibit sexual conduct between the parties, but they talk about it in the terms of the relationship. We want to prohibit this relationship. At one point, there was some discussion about, can we even do this? And they said, well, sure we can, because there's other contexts where we prohibit these types of relationships where there's sort of an inherent power imbalance, and one of them is as therapist-patient. So I've got about 3 minutes left. I would like to keep some of that, so unless there's any other questions, I'm going to go ahead and sit down.
Nothing additional.
Thank you.
Ms. Collins?
Good noon, Justices. How is everyone? I would assume that we want to discuss Mendoza and its application to the second portion of the kidnapping statute. I can tell the court that in our practice, especially regarding child sex cases, that instruction is never requested. I think in circumstances where we may have a stranger danger, where the aspiration of the victim may increase the risk of harm, we've had it asked for in those contexts. But generally, when we talk about an adult secluding a kid, those cases happen in secret, and they happen in seclusion. So there's always movement. That movement is always incidental. There's always an increased risk of harm because they're being taken away from an environment where they can be caught.
Well, Ms. Collins, down below, it seemed that you argued...
I'm sorry.
At the trial court, it seemed that you argued that Mendoza didn't apply because it only applied to certain enumerated felonies. On appeal, you were citing Wright and seemed to be talking about whether the conduct's incidental or not. Do you agree that Mendoza should apply to this situation?
I do not. I do not believe Mendoza should apply to this situation. I probably should have had some more time with the appellate brief. Oftentimes we don't. We have taken the position that this portion of the statute was created and carved out to protect minors. And if you put those extra components on there of Mendoza, or extra analyses of Mendoza, if you will, it really renders that special protection for minors kind of meaningless. Because there's always going to be an increased risk of harm to a minor. That's why we created the exception legislatively. If someone takes a kid to perpetrate.
We're talking about a kid. We are talking about a kid, but in this context, we're talking about a 16-year-old who is the age of consent. The legislature saw fit to penalize the power imbalance or that relationship by 1 to 5 years. So they've said this is horrible, we want to protect minors, 1 to 5 years. A kidnapping is 5 to life. So if they've identified that relationship and said this is a 1 to 5, does it seem as if at least a jury should be instructed on what's incidental before they apply a 5 to life to that conduct?
I respectfully disagree. I mean, he could have continued to have sex with her at school. Quite honestly, we've charged similar circumstances where doors were locked as kidnapping. But in this situation where he took her to a hotel room out of the school day, surreptitiously, does he deserve extra punishment for that? And the state thinks he did. And I still do. He didn't get 5 to life, he got 5 to 15. The life sentence wasn't imposed, but in this circumstance, and in any circumstance where an adult takes a minor, we're just talking about a minor, whether she's of the age of consent or not, there's always inherently an increased risk of harm.
But doesn't that infringe on the defense? In other words, the defense has a right to a jury instruction on Mendoza. I mean, why would you even object to it in this particular case? Because of the age and everything.
Because we believe the language of the second portion, he took her, he led her, he carried her away to perpetrate a crime upon a minor. Not perpetuate, perpetrate a crime upon a minor, the person of a minor.
But that's your theory. Maybe Mr. Waters or whoever the trial attorney was, maybe had a different theory and is entitled to the jury instruction.
And again, we have argued its inapplicability where the exception for the minor is carved out.
And you have a case that says that?
No.
Because Mendoza is a big case. I mean, that's a big case. We fought, and the defense bar fought a long time to have Mendoza as a jury instruction so that jurors would understand kidnapping.
And it does.
Because it used to be, we used to argue merger, which they could never understand merger.
And I understand. And as to the enumerated felonies, I absolutely concur with your position that if you can commit a sexual assault or a homicide or a robbery, which is a crime that occurs in a public place, generally a store, If you can commit that robbery and there's not an associated kidnapping, then there should, without an increased risk of harm to the individual, then absolutely a kidnapping or dual criminal responsibility should not lie. But in the situation of a kid, when you're talking about these kinds of crimes, they are always going to be done in secret. There's always going to be some movement, and that movement is always going to be incidental. And by the very nature of secluding that kid, there's always an increased risk of harm. So we have taken the position that defense is not entitled to additional instructions of what's already built in the statute. That's the position we've taken.
So essentially it's a strict liability offense?
No.
Why not? That's kind of what you just argued.
In what manner would it be strict liability?
Well, if it's all you're saying, it's always done in private and there's always some type of a movement, it's essentially a strict liability offense.
Well, it's prosecutorial discretion, and there has to be some intent to perpetrate a felony on a kid, on a minor. So, I mean, you still have to have the companion felony or the companion intent, so I don't think it's strict liability. I mean, we still have to meet our burden of proof. I guess that is the way that we've argued it, that's the way we've interpreted it, because otherwise it is kind of doubling up the requirements, if you see my...
Well, you were very honest when you said it's to get them more time. There wasn't enough time on the teacher-student sexual intercourse.
Quite honestly, he should have been charged with the enhancement about school property, and he was not.
Ms. Collins?
Yes.
Can you say that no reasonable jury could have found that this was incidental? Because that's really a question. Could a reasonable jury have found otherwise if they were instructed pursuant to Mendoza? So can you say that?
I don't think so. I mean, it certainly helped him consummate his goal. I mean, you know, we all know what his goal was from his, you know, 3,800 very sexually salacious text messages. So I don't think so. answer any more questions I could ask in front of him. I have some more time left. So as to the individual prosecution for the individual acts, I don't think there's anything in the statute that precludes that. I think that goes to the heart of prosecutorial discretion. I don't know when the legislature defines the kinds of sexual conduct that falls under that rubric. Certainly, I don't think that they meant to give us only the discretion if there was a one-year relationship going on that we could only charge 1 pound. So,
didn't the judge run all the sexual offenses concurrent?
Yes, he did.
Okay, so it wouldn't change the sentence, whether it was one or a bunch of them, it's the same sentence.
Correct.
And that piece of it, the bitty ran, they can kidnapping, all of them concurrent but consecutive to the sexual conduct.
That is correct. I assume the court doesn't have any questions about the instruction regarding specific intent to her age. They argued that the defendant had to have specific intent as to the age of the victim. There was a novel argument kind of brought up at the beginning of this brief, and I just want to talk about it very briefly. It was mentioned that because this offense falls under the rubric of crimes against decency and morals, that there is no victim, and this is somehow some kind of crime against the community, and ergo it does not fall under the kidnapping statute. That argument kind of falls flat. If you look under the rest of that chapter section, that also houses lewdness with a minor, pandering, also houses sex trafficking. So I don't know how this individual would not be a victim for purposes of the kidnapping statute. And certainly I also wanted to point out to the court that very recently, victims under this section were afforded the right to privacy for their identity. So they have been included with other sexual assault victims. I don't know if you have any questions about the definition of entice, but I did want to give you a couple comments on that. Largely what drove the voir dire in this case, as well as the rebuttal, were discussions with defense counsel at the beginning of this case, which caused us to file a motion regarding nullification. In other words, you can't argue to this jury because you think she was 16 and 17, that she was able to consent, therefore this law should be abandoned, which was kind of the discussions we were having back and forth. What caused my definition of entice in rebuttal argument was defense counsel's repeated argument to that jury that dominion and control over this victim were required for them to find the kidnapping. And that's not true. And he used, he provided definitions or at least argument that made enticement sound like it required dominion and control. So that is where, that's why that argument was offered in rebuttal. It certainly wasn't taken to distract from what had already been offered, but it was fair comment on what defense counsel had to say.
Ms. Collins, do you think the court should have given a different or given some sort of guidance? I don't know that enticement is an ordinary term. When the jury asked about enticement and wanted a reread of your definition, should the court have either approved that definition or given them a little more guidance on it? Just curious your thoughts.
Would it have been nice? Yes, now in hindsight. absolutely. I certainly wasn't, I recall I got that definition off my phone while I was listening to him use the word entice, about 6 or 7 times. So would it have been nice to have something from the court? Absolutely. Is it detrimental? Does it change anything? Does it change the strength of the evidence in this case or ultimately the jury's verdict? Or was it prejudicial to Mr. Lofthouse? I don't think so. Would it have been favorable or nice? Yes, absolutely. I don't have any more argument unless anyone has anything for me.
Any additional questions?
No.
Thank you. Mr. Waters?
I know we're only 3 minutes. There's a lot I would like to get to. I'm obviously not going to, but I do think Justice Peregrine made a really good point with respect to this kidnapping. If, with Ms. Collins saying, well, it doesn't matter because we're giving special protections to minors, whatever, then it is a strict liability offense. Every offense against a minor is also a kidnapping. If you don't have to prove incidental or, you know, increase the risk of harm. And I gave some examples in my brief about how we can get into some really absurd places with that. If I take a minor by the hand, lead him in the street, that's an unlawful act. That's also a kidnapping. If I entice a minor to ride a horse in the highway, that's an unlawful act. That's also a first-degree kidnapping. So, and I do want to point out, and I know this is not mandatory authority because it is an unpublished case, but it is from this court, and it does post-date 2016. It was Downs versus State, 217 Westlaw, 2815092, where this court did recognize a situation where the state pled first-degree kidnapping, where child abuse was the associated offense, and they did talk about the necessity of a Mendoza instruction in that case. That is not one of the crimes that is alleged in the first part of the statute, one of the enumerated offenses. So, admittedly, that's not binding authority on this court, but it is, I think, persuasive, very persuasive, and it's from this court, not the Court of Appeals. I think Ms. Collins even kind of recognizes that they could have charged him with kidnapping if he had locked him, or in cases where they have a locked door. Well, that's kind of what happened in this case as well. Just because she chose not to, under her theory, like, because it's always a kidnapping, they could have. And now you're getting into situations where every sexual act also includes a kidnapping because, and I, you know, I don't think it's radical to sort of suggest that when two people are engaged in sexual conduct, there is always some sort of movement or detention.
Is there a substantial increase in the risk of harm by going to a motel? I mean, if you're at school, somebody may walk in, there's students, there's other people. If you take somebody to a motel, isn't there an increased risk of harm?
What harm are we talking about? Like, her mental harm is probably worse if you're still in the school and she gets caught because of the things that the other students would probably do to her, say about her, and so forth. Physical harm? I don't know. I mean, minors are allowed to go to hotels, casinos all over Las Vegas. They can't gamble, obviously, but they can go there to bowl. They can go there to, like, play in the arcade. And again, I understand we're dealing with, like, statutes that say one thing, but she's 17 here, so she had the legal right to consent to sexual intercourse with a 32-year-old man. Any other 32-year-old man. Now, she couldn't with Lofthouse because he was her teacher, but in every other situation, if he was not her teacher, what she did, none of that is illegal. It's not kidnapping. It's not, the sex itself is not a crime. So I understand the legislature's concern about these relationships, and I completely admit that they, although this statute I do have some problems with, but not under these facts, their desire to criminalize this, but, you know, sorry.
Finish your story.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. When I heard the beeper, I lost my train of thought, so I apologize. The beeper threw me off.
With that, this matter will be submitted.
Thank you.